This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila. And we are Spy Fat Chicks. And in this episode, we're going to be doing a book review. It is called The Fair and Cheer of Good Old... The Good, Fair, and Cheer of Old England by Joan Perry Dalton.
And this is a title that we have messed up and mangled for the past, like, 3 months. So we're going to put it on the website so you could just copy and paste it whatever search engine you want. So I'm sure as we talk about the book today, we're going to screw it up.
Yeah, there's going to be lots of variations.
Yes.
But the book is out of print, so you have to go to either eBay or an online bookseller to get it. Or you can check out one of your local used bookstores.
Yes.
Or maybe your local library as well.
And we've found a great search engine online that is really good for finding different books used, or even new if you have a hard time locating it in your area. It kind of spiders out there and finds all the books, all the booksellers, and looks for those books, and it ranks them according to price. So you can actually find the book for the cheapest price possible. We'll make sure we put a link up for that as well. But where did we get this one used from? I know we got it originally from the Aurelia Library. We went to the library back in, I think it was August, and I wasn't even in the cooking section. That was the crazy part. I was wandering around like by the travel section, and I just happened to glance over, and I thought, that sounds like a cool book. It has lots of happy adjectives in it. It's about England and food.
I think we actually got this one from indigo.ca.
I think so, too. But we checked it out from the Aurelia Library. I read it, and then Sheila read it, and we both just said, wow, we have to do a podcast about this sometimes. It's so cool. And then couldn't get a copy of it unless we went online. And then realized it's horribly out of print. It's written in, like, 1960.
Yeah.
But that's part of the charm of the book, and that's why we like it. Because it really reads as a prelude to Last Chance to Eat, which we did an episode about way back.
Yeah. It's like Last Chance to Eat's positive older sister.
Mm-hmm.
The one that has the stiff upper British lip that sees the good in everything.
Well, my big gripe with Last Chance to Eat was the fact it was very...
It was down on British food.
It was down on British food. It was very Francocentric. And I still maintain that, yeah, French food's great, but it's not the be-all and end-all of fine dining or good food in general.
There are lots of other cuisines out there that produce marvelous food.
And if you want to talk about fancy frou-frou food, I think Japanese food goes head-to-head with French food.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at how intricate some sushi gets. So, to me, to be such a cheerleader, unabashed cheerleader for French food, especially when she slammed tamago, which is how you tell if a sushi restaurant is good or not. Anyway, I'm kidding. But even though she's such a cheerleader for French food and so down on English food, and she is English herself, and then we pick this up and read it, and it was, like, soul uplifting. It was so good.
It's a book that you read, and you feel good after you finish reading it.
Yeah.
Because it's so positive.
Well, it was very telling, too, that it has recipes at the end of each chapter, much like how she had recipes in Last Chance to Eat, which is another parallel I enjoyed between the two books. But, I really liked that we were over at your friend Rick's place, and we had brought the copy from the library to show him, and he's like, what was it, forget cooking Julia Child's book, cook your way through this for a year, which this doesn't have nearly as many recipes. There's maybe 24 in here, but I mean, the recipes in this that come with each chapter, they're totally unadulterated old school English recipes. They're not messed up by modern whatever and simplification.
Because you're looking at pre-war recipes that she brought with her through the war. And
they're like family recipes, like her family's cooking things. So you're really going to see a lot of stuff in it that it hasn't been simplified to make it easier for the modern chef, which is nice.
And much like Tolkien, not a whole lot in rural England had changed before the Industrial Revolution. There were still pockets of places where you could, like, look way back even to medieval times. Things were pretty much done almost the same way.
We even look at it past World War I. It was a very simple kind of lifestyle if you went way far out. A little more in the way of modernization, but not much.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to the books. It's just so awesome. I think we're going to kind of hit this on a chapter-by-chapter basis, highlighting what we enjoyed the most. There's going to be some chapters we kind of skim over because they were good, but we didn't have anything we wanted to talk about. And we'll talk about the recipes as we go, but we may go back and review some of those as well, because there's a couple we want to try.
Yeah, definitely.
I know there was definitely a couple that I said, ooh, I want to make that. I do like in the beginning, she has equivalent measures between the American and English measurement system, so you don't have to kind of freeform it and hope to God you've picked the right number of ounces to put in something. So, I mean, they were definitely thinking when she put this together. And I believe this lady had written another book about gardens.
I think so, yeah.
But there's not much else out there. I don't even know if she's still alive. I couldn't find anything else online.
No. I mean, when I did a search for the book, the only thing I found was places to buy it online. And there's one recipe in there that was the maid's of honor cakes.
Oh, that's...
That occurred in a couple of different places online, and also apparently Emeril had used it for Emeril Live. He did a medieval cooking show. The Maids of Honor cakes have been referenced from this book.
And it's page 48. If you have a copy of the book, like all one of you that will probably end up getting a copy after this episode, page 48 has the recipe for the Maids of Honor.
And but... that's a recipe actually from, I think it was like 1525 or something.
Yeah. And just a general shout out, as time goes on and hopefully more and more people hear our podcast or listen to our podcast, if anybody has any information about Joan Perry Dutton, if she's still alive, which I doubt it, she would be, she was born pre-1900, so she's probably not with us anymore.
Probably not.
But if any of her kids are around or anybody like that, we'd like to know, we'd like to at least write a fan letter.
Yeah.
And we'd also like to find out if the book is on its way to becoming public domain. Because if so, we would like to record it for one of the services out there, like the Gutenberg Project or something.
Or archive.org.
Archive.org, so there's a audio recording of it. Because we really feel that strongly. It's just such an awesome
I would movie. Hate to see this book disappear from modern access.
Yeah, not only is so much crap out there about Paris Hilton and stuff like yeah. this is disappearing. So anyway, when you hit the first chapter, it's pretty much just an intro about what this is going to be about food from back home, food from England. And the only thing I really struck me in the very, very beginning was just she champions English food from, like, page 2 about how awesome it was and
yeah.
how Americans are down on English food, but in reality a lot of American cooking comes from English food, and we just don't like to admit it because we think
right.
English food is nothing but fried and boiled potatoes and fish.
Yeah. The other reason, too, is most Americans' exposure to English food came from them being stationed in England during World War II, which is when English food was a shadow, a ghost, a wraith
yes.
of its former self.
World War I and World War II.
Because of the rationing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really when English food was put through the ringer.
Yeah, and you didn't have the fresh ingredients you were used to having. You had dried eggs instead of the fresh eggs. There was all kinds of bacon rationing, which there's a great story later on in here about a fellow who was working around the bacon rationing. The pig rationing was awesome. So, yeah, everybody got a bad taste in their mouth for English food because of the wars.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't look beyond that to pre-war English cooking, which was just phenomenal.
Or it's simplistic stereotyping where you think it's just fish and chips and maybe beer.
Yeah. Which fish and chips and beer are fine, fine foods on their own.
Yes.
God knows I can exist on them.
I just looked down. There's more to English food than that.
I just looked down and almost had a heart attack. I thought the counter on the recorder said 0000, but it said 08.
That we were talking all this time for 8 minutes and not recording anything.
That would have been horrible. So the first real meaty chapter of the book is the breakfast chapter, which is the second chapter.
English breakfast.
Oh, I love English breakfast. English breakfast. Now, this is all going on Miss Dutton or Mrs. Dutton's point of view. English breakfast is really a three-course kind of meal. You have your kind of grainy carb thing, like a porridge, and then you have your meaty thing, and then after that you have your sweet thing, like a marmalade.
Yeah.
And that's your basic English breakfast.
What's the formula for it?
You know, when you look at that, though, that's a lot like your hearty American farmer's breakfast,
yep.
isn't it?
You have your fried potatoes, you have your meat and your eggs, and then usually you have toast and jam.
Mm-hmm.
As the sweet component, almost like a dessert for your breakfast.
Mm-hmm. And she takes credit in this for England for having really pioneered bacon as a food, as a breakfast food.
Yeah, so
bacon
if you like
and
bacon,
eggs,
you love England.
Yeah, if you eat bacon and eggs, you like English food, you just don't realize it, which is cool. I also enjoy the story about where marmalade really came from, though the preserves have been around for a while. There's old recipes about to make a marmalade out of something. The marmalade that we think of that's sold by the one house that's supposed to be really well known for it, House of Kyler.
Yeah.
K-E-I-L-L-E-R. Mr. Kyler had gotten a great deal on oranges and sugar. I guess a Spanish ship had to set into harbor early. They had to take refuge, and they had to just sell everything. So Mr. Kyler, you know, typical, I'm not going to say typical man, typical husband. Wow, look what I got, wife. I got a great deal on all this crap. And Mrs.
Wife.
Kyler. Mrs. Kyler, insert the Marge Simpson groan. Homer! And she's like, well, you know what? I might as well use my mother's recipe for marmalade and see what I can do with all this crap my husband brought home. And she just made a pile of marmalade. And it was so good. She used the same recipe she used for quinces. And it was so good, they started selling it. And that became the first orange marmalade from House of Kyler. And when she writes this in the book, orange marmalade from House of Kyler, it's like in, like, capital O, capital M.
Like it's a title.
It's a title. It's a proper noun.
Well, probably, I'm not sure.
This is something we need to look up and find a link for to see if this is still around, because I have a feeling it's like gourmet marmalade now.
Right. Well, the other thing I was going to say was, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but it might be one of those products that is dubbed by the Queen for majestic use.
Might be, yeah. That's something we will look up. It's from the House of James Kyler and Sons Limited of Dundee. And that was back in, let's see, 1700s? Late 1700s?
Probably.
And the way she talks about it, it's still around. So
at least as of the 60s.
Yeah. But I love that story, because it's such a modern story. It's something my dad would do. Look, yeah. Marianne, I got this great deal on blah. And my mom's like, I guess I can it. So I love that.
Before it goes bad.
Yeah, before it goes bad, we'll do something. And at the end of the breakfast chapter, she has recipes for some of the things she talks about, including her mother's marmalade recipe, which I know Sheila makes. An awesome marmalade that's not a traditionally made marmalade. She doesn't can it traditionally,
yeah.
But it's really good. But I'd be kind of curious to try this one in contrast to the one you made.
Yeah, I would definitely want to try it, because traditional marmalade is more of...
It's more of a preserve.
It's more of a preserve, and it's more bitey and citrusy. Whereas the marmalade that I make, it's kind of like... I make it whenever I make candied orange peels, and it just tastes like jarred candied orange peels that you spread on toast. It's very sweet. It's not at all bitter. And it just uses the oranges, and I use, like, a little bit of the skins, but I don't use any... Most old marmalade recipes calls for using the seeds, because the seeds are supposed to add bitterness to it. This one may not.
No, she actually says to pull the seeds out on this.
Okay, because there's people that like the marmalade super, like, face-puckering bitter, and there's people that like it more on the sweeter side.
Mm-hmm.
So this looks like it's going to be a sweeter marmalade.
Which I'd still like to try and compare, because your marmalade is really good.
Mm.
I'm not a marmalade fan, and I still really like it. And I know you've had a lot of positive reviews. And what type of marmalade is it?
Israeli marmalade. I just picture, like, Mossad guys eating scones with it on it.
In between shooting people. I mean, it's just... It was so cool. I came home from work one day, and she was all excited. She's like, guess what? I found an Israeli marmalade recipe, and I think it's a great way to use all those extra oranges up when I make candied orange pills. And she's just glowing. I'm like, that's great, honey. You've been home by yourself too long today, haven't you?
Yes,
I have.
Take me out. Anywhere. I don't care. The 24-hour grocery store. Let's just walk around and look at stuff.
So English breakfast rocks. There's a whole chapter about it. You need to read the chapter so you too can indeed agree with us that English breakfast rocks.
Yes,
and that's
it does.
Like a tongue twister. I know, I'm not even drinking.
Rocks.
Yes. I'm not even drinking. I'm having coffee. So next up is time for tea.
Tea.
And this isn't just about the meal of tea, which is a very English thing. Americans look at it and go, well, that's quaint. It's also about the actual beverage itself, which is near and dear to Sheila's heart. Our cabinet is stuffed full of tea.
You have to have variety. Variety is the spice of life.
You have way too much tea.
You have way too much variety.
Yes.
You have way too much spice of life.
Your life is too spicy. It's giving me heartburn with a wallet, and no, I'm kidding. tea, I'd like to talk about it just as the meal itself, which I know when I think about it as an American, before reading this, I was like, oh, that's such a quaint little custom. You sit down with your little sandwiches and your little cup of tea, and you have it in like the late afternoon. But when I think of it from a nutritional standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, because really we should eat multiple small meals a day, not two or three huge meals a day.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be pythons, we should eat like birds. And English tea lends itself to that, because you have breakfast, you have lunch, you have tea, and then you have your dinner later in the evening. So tea is kind of that spacer between lunch and dinner to make you last a little bit longer till dinner later in the evening.
Yeah.
Instead of eating dinner at like 4 o'clock and wondering why you're hungry at like 9 o'clock at night.
Well, it stops you from eating, because you're eating dinner later, that stops you from eating before you go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it stops you from eating snacks that aren't good for you.
Yes, because
during the day.
Tea's a fairly healthy meal if you eat it the way it's supposed to be eaten in English style. And this is something she brings up too in it, when she starts to talk about tea as the meal, is that it's a, it's a spacer that helps, as she puts it, stave off the too early cocktail hour.
Oh, yeah.
But it's meant to be a spacer meal, and that's so cool. That's all I have to say about the meal itself. I think it's a neat innovation. I don't know if I could full out adopt it to our lives. I know as a working person, it's very hard to do unless you live in a culture that has it.
Yeah, the way that people's breaks are usually spaced out, you don't have time to take tea, generally.
So, tea is the drink. I don't want to go into a full-blown tea
thing,
because that's like another episode.
Right. We already have a tea episode that we kind of have planned out. And there's also another complete book about tea that I read that I would like to review at some point.
Yes. But I need to get off my butt and read that.
The one thing that I would like to say about this book, with regards to tea, and you'll see this again, too, in the beef chapter, it's kind of amusing from a modern perspective to look at it as a hindsight is 2020 thing, because in this book in the 60s, they were wondering whether or not tea bags would totally replace loose leaf tea, and we would see the end of the teapot as we know it, mm-hmm. and the one for every guest and one for the pot.
Mm-hmm. Which I think would make an incredibly strong pot of tea.
Unless they're using smaller spoons.
Maybe,
there
you know
might
what?
Actually be a teaspoon
I'm
that they use.
It's a smaller, almost like a, not a dessert spoon, but like those little tiny spoons.
Like
I would have to
like
look
like
at where
tea spoon almost.
Yeah,
because
that makes more sense.
Whenever I make tea, I usually use like a heaping teaspoon.
And that's enough for
and
the
that's
two
enough
of us.
For the for the whole pot.
And that we use a pretty big pot, too.
And we usually re-infuse it a couple of times, too.
Well, we also are more likely to have a green tea. And green teas really lend themselves to reinfusing. But
yeah.
We do darker teas, too, that do lend themselves to reinfusing. You don't have to toss it every pot.
Right.
And we're cheap. That's a stretch your variety.
Frugal.
No kidding. Frugal.
Yeah.
No, tea really is meant to be drank multiple times.
Right.
Like that.
It's meant to be reinfused
yeah.
a couple of times. But anyway, they were lamenting the fact that tea bags are so widespread, so economical, they use a lot less tea and mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. But now, if you look at in this 21st century, loose leaf tea has really, it was never went away, so I can't really say it made a comeback, but there is definitely a market for gourmet teas
yes.
and little treats for people, for themselves,
mm-hmm.
that they can get. Because, well, I mean, you can't really take all that great loose leaf tea and just grind it up and throw it in tea bags.
Yeah.
That would be foolish.
And you have to make crazy, insane new tea bags to be able to accommodate some of the newer tea blends that have all the stuff in them.
Yeah.
And that's where you get the crazy triangle
the
tea
bag. The pyramid tea bags.
Yeah, which, you know, they're going to incredible lengths to make it easier for people to have, which is great. But you can get the same effect by just using a teapot if you're at home.
Yeah.
But I have to champion tea bags here and say there's a place for them, especially
yeah.
if you work someplace where maybe you don't have a tea infuser, travel mug or something. Which
right.
We're lucky we have those. But before we had those, it was all tea bags or nothing if we weren't at home.
That is true.
And what we're talking about are these awesome travel mugs that Sheila picked one up a while ago. And then our awesome friends Daisy and Jamie got us each one for Christmas. So we have one in a spare, which is nice when we have road trips.
Yeah.
We took the road trip to Montreal because we had one for each of us to use. But it's this nice insulated travel mug that has a strainer in it and then another lid on top of that. So you can put your tea in it and do your infusion in your mug and then just toss the leaves. Or you can put the leaves on the bottom if you're doing like a green tea where you
yeah.
should leave it in there. And then put the strainer on top of that so you can still drink and go.
Get some sort of double filtration action.
Yeah, we talked about it in the Montreal episode about how great that worked out.
Yeah.
The only thing I have to say is more of an anecdote she has in here. Well, two things, really. One is an anecdote about great customer service that you don't see anymore. I love how this was tested. And the other is that she has a good bit of history about Lipton and where Lipton came from as a trading house.
Yeah.
And it almost piques my curiosity enough that I'd like to go out and find books about the Lipton family in general. And that might be more of a spring project for me to do.
Yeah, because he's really, really like a genius, like a marketing genius.
It reminds me of Carnegie
yeah.
a lot. It reminds me a lot of the robber barons of the turn of the century in the United States. So, and that's something I've always enjoyed reading about, so I think I would enjoy the Lipton family story. But this was a story about a tea house, Jackson's of Piccadilly, and there was an old guy that came into Jackson's of Piccadilly at one point, and he came in with this incredibly complex order. I'm just going to read verbatim from the book.
Go ahead.
He said he lived in Ireland, and he wanted to send he wanted them to send him each month 2 pounds of tea, all in different varieties of 1/4 pound each. So that would be 8 types of tea every month, and he paid for a year's supply in advance. He never wrote to Jackson's, who, faithfully complying with the order, presumed the tiresome niggling was properly received. But one day, one of Jackson's clerks, who was making up the order, said, "Oh hell, no one could possibly really want these tiny quantities of different kinds of tea. I'm just going to send 4 half pounds. The general manager overheard, "Oh no, you're not. He paid for the different kinds, and that's what he's going to get no matter how tiresome it is." A year after the first order was placed, the old gentleman came in again. It turned out that he had a nephew in some far corner of the empire, and he wanted to send him a vast parcel each month made up of expensive things. "I just wanted to be quite sure that you would always follow instructions and always send the exact value ordered," he said. "So I thought I would test you with that complicated tea order. If you could keep that up for a year, I knew you were the store for me." I just love that, because
yeah.
how many stores would fail on that now, except for like small family-owned places?
I just think, even generally, as retail workers,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to put up with that kind of thing. We're not trained to do the job like that anymore. That's not a modern value.
Mm-mm. But I look at Slate Indulgence in downtown Morgantown, I could totally see them pulling that off without even, you know, a hair out of place.
Yeah.
You know, if you walked in there and said, I want you to mail me this, this, and this every month and pay for it in advance, they'd be like, sure. They'd put it in their computer, it'd pop up every month, and they'd mail it out to you. No, I'm sure they would do it.
Yeah.
But they're one of the few places of that kind of thing that I can think of that popped to mind right away that, yeah, they'd do it.
Maybe paying for it in advance helped a lot, too.
But then that was normal.
That's true.
So, but I just, I love that, because I think of how many places would fail, and then I think of the few shining examples I know of that would probably succeed.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. Tea, we're going to talk at length about tea on another episode, but awesome, again, awesome chapter. And at the end of it, she lists, like, all kinds of awesome, like, tea recipes, like scones and crumpets and all kinds of little tea cakes and Madeira cake.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, there's no Madeira in it, though. It's supposed to be served with Madeira wine.
Ah.
So, sandwich cake. So, anyway. I really don't have a lot to say about the old-time buns and cakes chapter, except
dessert, they're delicious.
It told us where Chelsea buns came from, which is a section of London.
Yeah.
Which we weren't sure of until we read this, where they came from.
I was pretty sure it had to do with Chelsea, London, but
I knew they were English. That's about all I could really tell you. But, again, great recipes at the end of the chapter. Ginger cake, which I know Sheila wants to try. She's a ginger fiend.
Yum!
There's a fish chapter after that as well. This is one, it's full of neat little historical tidbits. She doesn't give any recipes because fish is pretty much, as she puts it, prepared the same almost all over the world with a few exceptions.
Yeah.
She lists a couple other recipes in other chapters. There's like almost a whole chapter later on about savories and anchovies. So
yeah.
I can see why she chose not to do that. Now the next chapter is the meat chapter.
Rare,
medium, or well done. I'll have one of each, please.
Yes.
And I love this for the cute historical point of this is well before the mad cow scare.
Right.
So in this, English beef is king.
Yeah. Kobe, it hasn't even been heard of yet.
Mm-hmm.
When people want to order, they order a Maine lobster, they'll order an English steak,
yes.
British beef.
Yes.
You know, you're right, it was like the crown jewel of English cuisine.
Exactly.
And this is, again, where one of those, it's amusing in hindsight is 2020 things. Because she had no clue that in the 90s that was going to get blown away.
Yeah.
And that is such a tragedy.
But I hope it can get resolved, because
yeah.
I want beef. I want to try good English beef.
If anything, the organic farming movement, hopefully, will get rid of a lot of that.
Well, there's not necessarily, because organic doesn't necessarily mean it's safe, but we digress.
But they won't be feeding ground up sheep to herbivores.
Sure. Ground up sheep brains to herbivores is even worse. My little trivia bit for the chapter was actually about a terminology I'd never heard before, a baron of beef.
I'd never heard of that before either.
And it's the noblest joint, as she puts it, consists of both sirloins cooked and carved, uncut from the backbone. So you're talking about a huge chunk of beef. Mm-hmm. And she says even at her time, most modern chefs aren't willing to tackle it. I can see why.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
If you mess that up.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Like, I was nervous working with the lobsters, because I'm like, ooh, this is a lot of money, you know, or when I worked at a steakhouse and I had to make, like, lobster cakes, I'm like, this is $50 worth of lobster, I better not mess this up, get it right the first time.
I know, it's kind of scary, but also she does discuss Yorkshire pudding, which I had never had until I met Sheila.
Oh, Yorkshire pudding is awesome.
Yorkshire pudding is not pudding.
No, it's a British pudding.
Yeah, it's a bread.
Yeah.
And it's so good. Can you describe it for anybody who's as ignorant as I was?
The first time I actually had Yorkshire pudding, this is kind of an amusing story. It was at a wedding, and the Yorkshire puddings, they're puffy, and they're like a
pop,
like a dinner roll kind of.
Yeah.
Imagine a very light, fluffy, but almost like it's fried on the outside and baked on the inside, because there's a lot of lard in it,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of lard that it's cooked in, and it's baked in the oven, and I stuck my fork into it, and I cut it in half, and it went, I'm like, I deflated it. I broke it.
But it's still edible.
But it was still edible. And you basically cut it in half and butter it and eat it like you would any other bread. But
it's tasty.
It's delicious and tasty and filled with fat. And I guess one of the best ways to make it is with drippings, which would be any grease that you get from frying meat.
Mm-hmm. Or cooking meat.
Or cooking
meat. If you're
going
to bake your roast your roast.
Yeah.
You know, you pull it out, you pour the drippings out of the pan, and that's what you can use for your Yorkshire pudding.
Yeah.
So
it's like bread and grease.
Or if you have bacon drippings in the fridge, you know, you can scoop that out. Like Sheila's precious bacon dripping hoard.
Shut
up. It sits in the back of the fridge. Like, what's this? Bacon drippings? You're saving this? Yes, it's great to cook with. Okay.
It is. Oh, I don't use it all the time, but...
It's like a little jar of cardiac arrest for me. She's trying to kill me with food.
I am not.
You are too. So, let's see. I don't have a lot else to say about it, except it's another eye-opener of a chapter. There's so much good stuff about mutton, really good recipes.
I really wish there was more mutton in North America.
Yes.
I mean...
Lamb and mutton. Well, there's more lamb up here than down in the States, at
least. True. Mutton is such a delicious meat, and sheep are so easy to raise, and they'll pretty much graze anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rocky, flinty soil.
Oh, my favorite dumplings in China were the mutton dumplings. Mm-hmm. Nothing better than a good mutton dumpling. Yeah, you're right, though. We need more mutton up here.
Mm-hmm.
Dang it. Somebody who's a billionaire, get on importing and making some good commercials for that or something.
Yeah.
But I really do want to try two recipes in here. I'd like to point out the Lancashire hot pot. And it's not like hot pot like we're thinking Chinese hot pot.
Right.
It's like a stew.
Yeah.
And it just looks so good. Except for the kidneys in it. I'll probably pass on the kidneys. Mm. But it looks really good. And there's also Cornish pastry, which is pretty much a turnover stuffed with meat.
Is it pasty or pastry?
Pastry. I think. Pasty. You're right. I just decided to modernize
throw an
the
R
word.
In there.
Yes.
And the Cornish pasties we've talked about in other episodes. We talked about it in the ep where we were talking about...
Wasn't that Black Bear?
Yeah, when we were talking about West Virginia food.
Yeah, because this is what Cornish miners ate. And then we're talking about pepperoni rolls in Morgantown. So it's back in episode one. For those of you who haven't listened to it yet, do your homework.
Check
Go
it out.
Go listen to it. But I digress. It looks really good. I like the idea of, you know, a nice savory, flaky, meat-filled pastry of doom.
Yes.
So. Delicious. I don't dig all the organ meat that's in these recipes, though. But then again, I consider the time, and that was common and tasty.
Yeah.
And I still maintain that I don't need to eat organs until the zombies come, and that's fine.
I mean, even up into the 70s, organ meat was pretty prevalent. I just remember as a little kid going to... there was this grocery chain called Nob Hill Farms, and... It was weird because it was like a warehouse grocery store before there were warehouse grocery stores. This was back in the 80s.
That was the place with the shampoo and the cooler, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had so much crap, they just put kind of stuff everywhere. Like, you'd see the shaving cream in with the butter.
Yeah.
And then you'd see, like, the shampoo was, like, in with the milk.
It was weird.
It was really strange. But they had this really huge, long butcher case. And I remember going there with my mom and seeing pig's heads on display in the case. And, like, stacks and stacks of trotters, you know?
Yum.
It's just, and all the organs and everything, and head cheese.
Well, that's the kind of stuff my grandmother ate, because that was good. And there's a lot of good vitamins in there, and I can see why people would crave those if you had a less than varied diet, because that may be the only time your body got certain types of vitamins, and that might
so you're
be
like,
why you want them.
Fried brain, I'm craving it.
Yeah,
right?
Well, not necessarily fried brain, but yeah, like
whatever.
Liver, and is liver full of iron?
Yeah.
It's a great source of iron. It's a tasty, soft part of the animal that you don't have to cook to death.
I'm guessing if you prepare it right, it's good. We're like, okay, when the zombies come, I will eat it without complaint.
Yes.
But until then...
But when the zombies come, everything becomes meat. It's not, what are we having for dinner? Beef. No, we're having meat. We don't need to know where it came from. We don't need to know what part of the animal it is. It's just meat. You will enjoy your meat.
Yes.
That's it.
Enjoy your meat sandwich.
Yes. Don't ask where it came from, so... But yeah, I'm not an organ person.
Yeah. I like steak and kidney pie.
Yeah.
I like some types of organ meats.
I've tried it. And it's not like it's me saying, ew, those are parts of the body that do stuff. I mean, I had kidney, and I didn't like it.
It's just nothing special, and you don't really care to eat it again?
Yeah, because I wasn't, you know, starving and running from zombies.
Right. I've eaten, like, the turkey heart before, and it's okay. I wouldn't go out of my way to eat it.
Why did you eat a turkey heart?
My Aunt Marianne cooked it. She always cooks the organs at Christmas time.
Okay.
Throws salt and pepper on it and eats it right there in the kitchen because nobody else really wants it. Now that my grandmother isn't alive. It used to be that she'd cook it and eat it. She was my grandmother's
organ meat
buddy.
Friend.
Oh. Yep.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, I tried some of the turkey heart. I tried the kidneys.
I mean, heart's supposed to be good, too, if cooked properly. It's a tough muscle, but it's supposed to be good.
Well, I mean, it tasted all right, but I wouldn't go out of my way to eat it.
Yeah.
But, hey, zombies are here. I'm down with that.
I'm going to gnaw a piece of heart myself, then. The next chapter is one of my favorites in the book, is The Gentleman Who Pays the Rent, and it's all about pork.
Mmm, pork.
Put pork on your fork.ca. The advertising works. And it's just a delicious, delicious chapter, because I like ham, I like bacon, I like pork in general. I've become such a pork fan over the past couple years, too.
Well, there's a lot of pork up here, and there's a lot of good pork.
Well, even before we moved, I kind of started to warm up to it. But it took a little doing. You have to cook it right.
Yeah. You can't overcook it.
Yeah, pork cooked badly is an abomination. Pork cooked well is just...
Divine.
So, my favorite part of this chapter is a story from World War II about this farmer who is fattening up a pig. And a pig at 220 pounds becomes a bacon pig. At 300 to 400 pounds, and 500, it becomes a ham pig. At that point, you don't really grow them any bigger. You just kind of slaughter them and do what you need to. And this farmer had grown this pig to just a quarter ton. And a miller had stopped by and asked, you know, why are you continuing to do this? And the farmer said, bacon rationing. And here's his figures from the book. I reckon that we're in for a good 15 years of it. On rations of 4 ounces of bacon per head per week, the pig is now only big enough to keep me, the wife, and son in bacon for 12 years and 3 months. He's got to grow big enough to supply 2 years and 9 months more. So this farmer had this huge pig. He's like, I could fatten him up to 15 years worth of bacon for the family. I'm like, wow. I don't know. That's just the best pre-planning I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You're like speechless. You're like, I don't know what to say about that.
Well, that's just the kind of ingenuity that we don't have to have anymore. And I'm sure that if our generation were put in that situation, we would get it back like that. But You don't see that kind of creative problem solving.
I'd also like to point out bacon, in this case, means pork in general. It used to mean all pork. Now it just means the back bacon. The back stuff.
The belly.
The belly and sides, I'm sorry. This says back and sides. I think maybe she's talking about pea-mill, too.
Yeah, she's probably talking about, actually, Irish loin bacon or pea-mill bacon.
Yeah, insides and everything else. All the deliciousness, which is great with, you know, a little bit of tomato fried up on the side and eggs. So, I'm sorry, I'm kind of making myself hungry for some breakfast for dinner or something. And I also liked her talking about what bangers are, which for the North American, we don't necessarily realize bangers is sausage.
Yeah.
And pre-war and post-war bangers, two totally different things. Because during the war, they stuffed them with so much bread that it was
almost
not
like
really
a bread
sausage. Yeah. Like the one quote was, you know, I don't know if I should put marmalade or...
I don't know if I should put marmalade or gravy on it.
Gravy on it, exactly. Because there was so much bread in it. And
like
even
filling.
Now, I think there's a problem with the meat content of sausage in England. Because I think I remember something from one of Gordon Ramsay's shows.
Yeah, and...
Was the F word? One of the episodes they were talking about how sausage isn't as good as it used to be, and you don't know what's in it, and the meat ratings are so low on them. And there's certain qualifications, depending on what the label says, tells you what high of a percentage of meat it is. Which is a foreign concept to me, because over here, sausage is sausage.
It has
to
be like 100% meat, pretty much.
Or like 99%, because there's 1% seasoning or something
like
that. Yeah,
you'll have to have like some spices in it, but that's pretty much it.
Exactly. So I think of something totally different on that. But again, different cultures, different time period, very interesting to read about. Anything on meat you want to toss in? Because we're going to get to my next one that just drives home a point I just love making.
Yeah. Let me take a look.
Sure.
And see if there's anything that I wanted to add out of here.
While Sheila's looking, I'm just going to say we read this back in August and then picked up our copy. This is December now. So we reviewed the book and we've written down our notes. But it's really something that I could almost sit down and read this thing like once a year. Like some people read Lord of the Rings or... They sit down with their favorite book they read. It's just so neat.
Well, they talk about pork and beans, which... I don't know if you ate a lot of pork and beans.
You mean like baked beans?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there was almost no pork in them. My mother didn't add bacon to the baked beans. She'd get the cans, she'd throw them in a pot, she'd doctor them up with whatever... I think she added like more ketchup and a little more brown sugar to it and something else. But she would add all that stuff to it, but I don't ever remember her adding bacon. The bacon that came in the can was all the bacon that was included in the baked beans. I know your grandmother...
Yeah, we have decided for a more British version of pork and beans, which is brown sugar, usually ketchup, and...
Lots of bacon.
Lots of bacon on top.
And remember the bacon made grease it, and it was bacon-y.
Would drizzle on down through the beans, and then you lift the lid off so the bacon can get it all nice and crispy on top. And then you pull it out. We usually always have that for... any special occasion, like Thanksgiving or Christmas, whenever somebody makes pork and beans.
Now, did you guys do Heinz or Campbell's or...
For the beans?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter the beans. We didn't really have a preference for the beans.
Okay.
It was whatever you could find. I think actually when my uncle made it this year, he actually bought the beans and soaked them.
Okay,
which was a first, because my grandmother just used to open up the tins and throw them in.
He did do it from scratch, and it was really good.
Yeah, it was definitely worth it.
I know... Like, in England, Heinz is a really big brand, whereas over here you see more Bush's and Campbell's in the States.
Well, what do you see in Canada most often? Is it more Heinz?
You don't see Bush's at all. I don't remember. I know we've looked at it at the store. I want to say maybe it's Campbell's and Heinz. But yeah. Even the labels look different. But I remember my parents usually, as I got older, Mom always bought Bush's because they're really good.
Yeah. So. But I know that, like, pork and beans is kind of like a quintessential, like our, like your grilled cheese sandwich, you know, in mm-hmm. the States. It would be, you know, you'd have like a little plate of beans and some toast, and that would be like a light meal or a snack.
See, for us, it was always a picnic food. We always had it when Dad did like hot dogs and hamburgers. Mm. That was when you pulled
it's
out the baked beans.
Food.
Yeah, it was
yeah.
barbecue food. We didn't or have it any other
food.
Time. Yes, I remember every potluck, really, somebody would bring a thing of beans, a crock of beans, if you will.
Yeah, I guess that was probably huge in the South, too, because you get the bean crocks.
Yeah. Well, remember the one Lilac's ad? And Gallery of Incredible Food had the crock of beans.
Yeah, it had
on the
like
picnic.
This big thing of beans, and it had all these wiggly hot dogs sticking out from all over it, like prehensile tentacles or something.
Well, no, there was another one where they actually had the crock on a picnic.
Yeah.
And there was like the caption was like, "Why did you bring the crock? It's all we have all the Tupperware for," or something like that. So, the game and game pies chapter, I've got nothing. It looks delicious, except for the jugged hare, which is just like the jugged kipper recipe
from Two Fat Ladies.
So. The next one, though, is sauce for the goose. And it makes me happy because it talks about English sauces, which apparently the Normans brought sauces with them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it still kind of came from France, but you know what? It's not... The font of all sauces did not, like, flow forth from modern-day France, which
right.
makes me happy. I like the idea that England still lays claim to some sauces as being theirs. The five that she talks about that she remembers growing up with are... apple, mint, bread, onion, and horseradish sauces. Mm. I'm like, oh, and all of them sound good. And she gives recipes, I think, for nearly all of them at the end.
And that's funny, because I thought that horseradish sauce would have been like an Eastern European thing, but apparently
no, well, horseradish
it's a British
grows
thing.
Out in Europe. Because it's an Eastern Europe thing, too.
That's true.
I know that's a big thing to have horseradish on the side with a lot of Eastern European foods. I remember as a kid, my parents would take a basket to church for Easter to get blessed. Like at our church, you take on Easter weekend, take a big basket of food down. Like it has Pascha and a whole bunch of other stuff in it. And the priest will bless them all for Easter. And they always would put horseradish in the basket when they took it down to bless it.
You need to have blessed horseradish.
Yeah.
Don't want some devilish horseradish.
No, it would be very sinful. But horseradish is great with ham.
Yeah,
and usually they serve it with roast beef on a buffet, but it's great with ham. That's how my dad eats it.
You definitely have that Eastern European thing going, because we would always serve mustard with ham and mustard with roast beef.
That Christmas Eve, when we cut the ham open at midnight, I'm going to have a great helping of horseradish on it.
Ooh, I actually found a good recipe on one of the forums for blue cheese dip, and it's got, like, horseradish in it and blue cheese,
ooh.
And it's for... They recommend the implement of eating as being extra thick cut ruffles.
Is it like mayonnaise based though?
No.
Oh yeah, it's a stuff. I really like her recipe for bread sauce, and it reminds me again of the one we saw in the episode of Two Fat Ladies where they were cooking for the Gurkhas.
Yeah.
And we both said, that looks like an awesome sauce. And it's a classic English sauce. You put it on almost anything. It's really good on meat. It's supposed to be excellent with birds, and isn't that how they served it?
Yeah, didn't they serve it with pigeons, actually?
I think they served it with pigeons, which...
I could be wrong.
I think it was, too. We might be wrong. We'll review the episodes again someday. We watch them, like, every 6 months or something. So, I really dig the sauce chapter. A lot of cool recipes in it, and it again, drives home that, look, we're English, but we season our food with things
yes.
like sauces.
Yay!
So, and salad dressings, actually, they're more likely to use malt vinegar in a dressing than wine vinegar.
Well, that's one of the things, I don't want to get, like, too much into it, but people, when they think of British food or medieval food, they think it's mm-hmm. meat, meat, meat. But there was a lot of salads in medieval times,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of salads in England, too, because it's the home of the Victory Garden. Come
yeah.
on, I mean...
Well, actually, that blends right into the next two chapters, because we can just jump right into
it.
Yeah,
just slide on
the next two is the vegetable gardens and the fruit gardens. And the vegetable garden thing, it always makes me think of Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah.
Because of the Curse of the Were-Rabbit with the veg...
Yeah.
And they're talking about the big garden contest. And whenever I would watch, like, any British show, there'd always be somebody talking about their vegetable garden. And that just struck me as a uniquely English thing, uniquely British thing to grow vegetables in your little garden. Which, as a kid, we did that anyway growing up.
Yeah.
Just because it was something to do in the summer when my parents were off. But I love that. And I love seeing it in Wallace and Gromit and everybody, like, jealously gardening their prize carrots.
Yeah. Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, was a great movie. Fun for young and old, like... But I'd also like to point out, too, that going back to the cases of mad cow disease, ever since, I think even maybe a little bit before then, like in the 70s, we started seeing more and more vegetarians in Britain. Because
mm-hmm.
there's quite a few vegetarians in England, It has to do some with that and some with dietary concerns.
It's also expensive to eat meat out there from everything we've seen. So
I remember my mom talking about how hamburger even was so expensive in England that they viewed it as a treat. And here in North America, you know, we have so much hamburger, we just, it's like a, it's junk food.
Well, you have the American mentality, too, of, by God, I'm a red-blooded American, and I'm going to gnaw on this giant steak that are just ripped off the cows that ran by.
Yeah.
And that's, it's good on one hand, because there's a lot of good things in red meat for you, but if you overdo it, and you don't balance it out with other stuff.
Too much of anything is not good for you.
You run into some of the uniquely American issues of clogged arteries and whatnot, but to contrast that, having a, I'm not going to say carnivorous diet, because I don't want to go completely off the deep end and be wholeheartedly Atkins, but in a way, leaner meats are definitely better for you than going on a bad vegetarian diet. And that's something I think you and I discussed the other day about you, if you're not careful and you don't know what you're doing, you're just going to be vegetarian without thinking about it, you run a great chance of just really wrecking your diet because you're going to eat stuff full of sugar because you're going to eat the easily available foods.
Yeah.
You're not going to go for the foods that you have to work a little to make.
Right.
So you're going to eat processed crap. And that defeats the purpose of doing it, to have a more natural diet. You're better off getting a nice loin of pork and slicing it and cooking it leanly, grilling it or baking it, and having a nice, healthy side dish with it.
And deciding to have a couple of meatless days. And on the days that you do eat meat, choose lean meat.
It goes a long way. So,
anyway.
But yes, the gardens. I dug the recipe for the stuffed marrow in here, too. It's stuffed marrow is like zucchini or cucumber, I think.
Yeah.
And you stuff it with, like, meat. So, you know, the Trojan horse vegetable. Oh, look, it's a vegetable. Ah, meat! I like that.
How did you get in there?
Oh, no. You know, the vegetarians run in fear from the table. I would never do that to somebody willingly unless I was really close with them.
Yeah.
And I like to tease them.
That would be a Pendulette's Dirty Tricks for Dear Friends.
Yes.
Because they put out that entire practical joke book that you should never pull on somebody unless they're a very good friend, because otherwise they won't be your friend anymore.
Yes, or pull it on a dear enemy. I know there was, you mentioned something about the fruit one you wanted to discuss.
Well, it kind of talks about the fruit chapter and the veggie chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you didn't see that there was very much there that we could discuss, but I think that with the urban homesteading movement, where more people are trying to have little gardens, where more people are trying to try and get back to old homesteading projects, like preserving and things like that.
I know, you don't want to see a simpler way of life, because it's not simple. It's more complicated.
It is way more complicated.
But it's a homier way of life.
Yeah, and, well, we saw that great article, too. And this is just kind of like, I guess, devil's advocate. It was an article from Slate talking about, is it really more economical to make preserves?
And they broke down each different type of food.
Yeah.
Is it cheaper to make it or buy it? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they found out, like, half the things are cheaper to make, half the things are cheaper to buy.
Yeah.
Wasn't it, like, bagels? Was bagels the one where it was cheaper to buy it?
I think so, because they're a lot more involved to make than people think.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not really into baking, then it's too much. And jams, actually, unless the fruit is free, you are much better, like, unless you're growing it, or someone is like, hey, here, have 5 pounds of blackberries or whatever.
Or you're doing the thing where you're saving all of your leftover berries and making that all berry jam. Like,
oh, yeah, the wild berry jam?
From the medieval cooking blog. Remember
that
where you saw that? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like that, whether or not that principle works to be more economical. But if you're just going to go out and buy, like,
if you go out and buy frozen berries to do it, you're throwing away money.
Yeah.
And I know that when this book was written, jams were okay. But look at the technology we have now, where we have some really great tasting preserves that you can just go and buy.
Unless you're doing it for dietary reasons.
Right.
Because, I mean, you look at
that way you can control exactly what's going
into it. How much sugar's in it. Maybe you don't like the taste of the commercial ones that are the less sugar ones, or you can eat the sugar, but you're not happy with the high fructose corn syrup garbage that, you know, makes you want to die.
Yeah.
So I can see where people like that might be inclined to make their own jams or things. But yeah, you're right. This does harken back to some of, well, not harken too forward, actually, the homesteading movements today that are out there.
Yeah.
Where people are trying to make their own stuff.
In a lot of ways, people are desperately trying to cling to these skills that we feel should not be lost.
Mm-hmm.
These are very important, valuable skills that we've relied on for 2,000 years, and it just seems foolish to just throw them away to the wayside.
Well, how many people our generation know how to can? You're like,
yeah. Okay, well, our generation, we're talking people in their 30s. I'd probably say at least half of them, or at least they know the theory of how it happens.
I'm going to say less than that. I was going to say a tenth, if that. because I grew up with it, and I was about one of the only people I knew growing up whose family canned anything.
Yeah.
And my mom did tomato sauce and cucumbers, usually. Yeah. And not pickles every year. And she did peaches as well. We had that, not peaches, pears. Because we had that huge pear tree in the backyard that just gave off piles of pears. Let me tell you, a pear tree unattended will grow out of control and take over the yard. I mean, at one
and attract monkeys from the zoo.
And attract monkeys from the zoo. And at one point, I was worried as a kid. I'm like, are these going to fall in the pool? I mean, the pear tree was just... So, it's delicious. It was a pain in the neck. My mom cussed it every year doing all that. But at the same time, we had all those tomatoes from the garden. And it did make really good tomato sauce. I mean, it was better than anything you could buy.
Yeah.
And the pears, the canned pears were great. And by canning, I mean she put it in the glass jars.
Right.
But the canned pears, you know, were great with ice cream, or you could just crack it open and have it, like a fruit cocktail kind of deal.
Yeah.
And when my parents did pickles, their pickles were awesome. Right. So,
well, I'm going to say, because my grandmother never actually did, I think she did like a little bit of canning, but she taught me how. So I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually did some canning together. We made like that salsa and canned it. But I would say people that are from my sister's generation that are 20 or under probably have no idea.
Yeah.
They are vaguely aware that there's mason jars involved and maybe boiling water, but they're not really sure what's going on.
But it's also a geographic thing.
That's
true. I'm sure people in a less urban area.
A rural area.
Know how to, whereas those of us who grew up closer to urban centers, many of us don't. I was an anomaly because my parents were just strange.
Yeah.
But again, mom's tomato sauce rocked. And I still remember that image going downstairs to the pantry area of the basement where the shelves were, just seeing this entire huge shelf of nothing but quart jars of tomato sauce. In one of those quart jars, she would mix sometimes a little bit of tomato paste she bought with it to thicken it up. But one of those would make like an entire pot of sauce for us to use for spaghetti or whatever.
Yeah.
Two of those, she'd make it a big pot of sauce. And it was good.
And I'm just thinking like how economical. Your real investment is your time. Because for that many quarts of spaghetti sauce,
mm-hmm.
compared to how much she paid for the seeds and how much she paid for the upkeep of the garden, that was a steal compared to if you had to buy all of those jars individually.
But it only worked because we grew the tomatoes as well. And my parents made sure they got the canning tomatoes. They didn't just use, you know, beefsteak tomatoes.
They don't work.
I think it's Roma tomatoes are really good for canning. I know they were funny shapes. And I think pretty sure it was a Roma one.
The elongated ones?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure those
Well, it's like how cider apples, when we get to the cider chapter, aren't like Macintoshes or Red Delicious. They're these little tiny inedible things that are specifically grown to make cider.
Yes. And we're going to skip the cheese chapter because Sheila will talk about cheese forever.
And
for like 2 hours. She doesn't give recipes for cheese because she even admits at her time that it's outside the scope of the average housewife. You're not going to make cheese unless you're doing it as a hobby.
And there are more books out there about hobby making cheese, and that is definitely something that I would like to try. I love cheddar. Cheddar is probably my favorite cheese.
And I love ricotta, and I really want to make fresh ricotta to cook with and blend down and do all kinds of tastiness. Cider. I know I don't have anything to add, but you're the cider fiend, so go for it.
I just like to read the...
Wait, before you do that, one last thing about the fruit. Apples. I loved the parallels between this and Last Chance to Eat, where in Last Chance to Eat, the author's lamenting the loss of all these different types of apples, whereas in this, because it's 40 years, 50 years earlier, she's just going on about all these great different types of English apples and all these different varieties out there, and it's an interesting curiosity having read both the books within a certain time period. So, I'm sorry, go ahead, read your quote.
Did you skip over the beer?
Yeah, I didn't have anything to add either. Well, there's not much to say. It's beer. It's delicious.
Beer is delicious.
I don't want to be like Reader's Digest condensed book.
Okay. Well, the chapter 16 is called Brave Old Cider. And there's this great little poem here at the beginning. When God had made the oak trees and the beeches and the pines and the flowers and the grasses and the tendrils of the vines, he saw that there was wanting a something in his plan. And he made these little apples, the little cider apples, the sharp cider sour apples to prove his love for man.
Nice.
Who wrote this ditty, I do not know, but he must have been a West countryman. And I like to think that he was from Herefordshire, where the lady who wrote the book is from. Because cider is as ancient in England as wine is in Rome.
It's an awesome chapter. Really good recipes in it, too. Cider cake recipes.
And cider is definitely making a comeback, too. It's with the craft beer movement. There is a lot more ciders now than there was in the past 20 years.
Well, I would say actually there's more up here than down in the States in the region where we lived.
Yeah.
If you go west coast, it may be different.
Yeah.
But East Coast, Pennsylvania, tri-state area, we had a handful of ciders and that's it. Up here, I mean, every LCBO you go to might have some different ciders you've never seen before.
There's a lot of, it used to be that the only things you could get were English ciders.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really, really good. But it's nice to have something from home, from your home region that you can be proud of. And
there are some killer Ontario ciders.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, there was the only cider we could really get was, it was from BC. It was Grower's Cider, and that was pretty good. And they had the different varietals. They had Granny Smith, they had Red Delicious, and those were pretty good. But I'm really glad to see all the things in the LCBO from Ontario.
Yeah. Well, Ontario apples are awesome, too, so.
They are.
It's very nice to see. And by cider, we do mean, when we talk about it, we're talking about alcoholic ciders.
Yeah.
When she talks about it, it's not necessarily always an alcoholic
it's
cider.
It's both.
Yes. The last chapter. This is the one that really, we're reading the book, we're like, this is awesome, and we hit this chapter, and it just put it from being, this is a really cool book, to, oh my god, this needs to be on our bookshelf and referenced regularly.
And we need to tell everybody about it, and they should read it too.
Yes. This is called Glorifying the Tin Can, Chapter 17, and this sums up, I think, completely coupled with something from the beginning I'm going to reference, almost our entire philosophy about food. So I'm going to go reference something from the beginning. And it is, she's talking about memory and food. Counterwise, talking of food is an evocation as well as a hungry-making business. There is nothing that makes us reminiscent more quickly than the tasting after a long interval of some favorite childhood drink or dish, unless it is the fragrance of some herb or flower. Sorry. Go ahead and mock me.
Herb.
I say herb, I know. Even as a glass of iced mint tea will do it, I haven't had that since I was a boy, and immediately the picture of the old farmhouse of the kitchen and the faces around the table comes back as clearly as if it were yesterday. This book is about the food of my childhood as we had it in the season. And then she goes on to talk a bit more about what it is. But one of the reasons Sheila and I go on and on and on about food is it's a reminiscent thing for us. And we're historically oriented people anyway. So that almost, in one breath, sums up a lot of what we want our podcast to be about. Not just about, we ate this great food, check it out. But, oh, by the way, and then we attach memories to that. Even if they're new memories.
We're very anecdotal.
Yes. So that is almost this five fat chick philosophy, or at least half of it. Now, when you get to this chapter, she opens it talking about in 1812 how the era of the tin can began, when Brian Donkin and John Hall created a tin canister that was filled with food and preserved and ready to go. And she speaks briefly about the history of food preservation at that point. A little bit about how people found that it wasn't really advantageous to do so with tin cans at home. They used glass jars. A little bit of reminiscent about canning as a child. The English concept of you have your pudding up season for different things, where the pudding up season for like marmalades and things started in January and December. And then your season would just continue as to whatever was ripe, and you would put that up, and it's a big pain in the neck to do, but it's totally worth it.
It ensures survival.
Yes, and I love, not just survival, it ensures comforts.
Yeah.
Because some of this you don't really need for survival. You don't need marmalade to survive, I don't think. Well, you do. I don't. But we're not that desperate yet. I'm sure when the zombies come, that marmalade will be survival, but right now it's a comfort thing. But it ensures a taste of out-of-season food that you may not have at that time, because transportation is not what it was today. We're so spoiled. We can go buy oranges whenever we want them. We're not waiting for some ship to come into dock so our husbands can go down and buy way too many oranges and sugar cheaply. So that's a big deal. But she talks about the one place, Cross and Blackwell, which used to sell the preserves and the nice porcelain Wedgwood containers, and how it came full circle, and how what used to be a common farm food is now was a gourmet kind of food. It was something that was the upper classes held in esteem, whereas in reality, this is a kind of food that was, you know, usually done in a farmhouse by a family with 12 kids.
It's like Brie's.
Yes.
We look at Brie and we hold it up on a gold pedestal.
Yes.
And as well it should be. But let's face it, where it comes from indigenously, that's farm food. And it's just as delicious there as it is here.
And she talks about the Cross and Blackwell tin can and how you can get Christmas pudding in it now, which I'd love to find.
Yeah.
Try to find some Christmas pudding before Christmas.
Spotted Dick.
And she goes on to all glory to the tin can. And then this, I want to find a good place to stop to read this. It needs to be done verbatim. It's so good. This is a long little section, and this is, again, I think, sums up the second half of this Vi-Fat Chick philosophy. Full of vitamins, the products of the robot canners may well be, scrupulously sanitary, the cooking vats of the factory, yet something is missing, even from even the best that the great food processors have to sell. Perhaps it is absence of the touch that goes indefinably with the love of a task well done by one's own hands. Perhaps it is lack of that intuitive wisdom with which all truly good cooks in my native countryside seem to have been born, and which is common to good cooks the world over. Or perhaps, and I think this is the nub, The tin can at most can hold only a good reproduction of the quote-unquote the real thing, that it is as the printed picture is to the painted masterpiece. No matter how fine the print, the original alone conveys the full warmth and genius of the artist who created it, putting something of himself on his canvas. Time is a great winnower. After a while, we are apt to tire of reproductions and prefer to hang an original on the wall.
Right there.
That's why we go out to restaurants instead of staying home and eating stuff out of a tin can. That's why we go out and pay obscene amounts of money for sushi when we could rehydrate dried salmon or something.
Right.
I mean, that's why people go out to eat, not just because it tastes good, but because it tastes better. And you're getting the cook's own touch in the food versus I just whipped the lid off of this and threw it in the microwave kind of thing.
Right.
Which is still nourishing and can be good for you, but it isn't the same. And that's why home cooking even trumps going out to a restaurant for most people, because it's the masterpiece you know.
Yeah.
It's the masterpiece, you know, you long to look at that picture that you saw every day going to college hanging in the hallway or something, in the whatever, regular building.
You know, might have a print of it in your office, but...
But seeing the original, you're like, wow, that's... It's the true masterpieces are the ones created by your family because they're made with love. The cook's loving touch. And then the next best thing is the cook's masterpiece touch, or the cook's professional touch when you go out. And then the worst is, you know, some person with a hairnet crammed this into a can and sealed it for you. And that is so true even now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is almost 50 years after this book has been published, and that's an idea that holds true today.
Despite as many advances that have been made in prepared foods, it's still... It's going to be adequate, but it's not going to be the same as your mother's meatloaf or your mother's roast beef or going out for a good steak with friends.
Or mom's pierogies versus the frozen pierogies versus the church old lady pierogies that you buy in Ambridge.
Frozen pierogies scratch the itch, but every once in a while you have to go home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have the frozen pierogies, which are like the printed reproduction. Then you have mom's pierogies, which are like the Da Vinci. And then you have the church lady pierogies, which are like the Picasso, you know?
Yeah.
You have two types of masterpieces, and you have this crappy print you hang in the dorm room with scotch tape. But, and the best part about this, because we keep drawing parallels between this book and the one written almost 50 years later, Last Chance to Eat, is that last chapter of Last Chance to Eat, when she's going on about how rare home-cooked food's going to be and how rare real food's going to be and blah, 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 blah. That's the perfect rebuttal. No, it's not, because people are always going to want the masterpiece. That's like saying, now that we can reproduce all these copies of the Mona Lisa, we're just going to burn the original.
And that would never happen.
Just because we have a digital copy of it does not mean we're going to ditch the original. And that is a 50-year rebuttal. It was like pre-written down. Like, someday they'll need this, so I'm going to write this at the end of my book. I love it.
Someday one of my fellow English women will just flip her lid.
No, I love that book.
Right.
And Gina Mallet did a really good job. I love it and I hate it. I think she's probably a wonderful person, and she knows more about food than I'll probably ever know. But nonetheless, I do disagree with some of the points she put forth in there, and I love that this gave me some confidence to rebut them, because this articulated things that we have both always felt that we couldn't put into words. And it gave us a springboard to go off on. So very, all in all, this is an awesome book. If you're friends of ours, like people we see all the time, you want to borrow it to read it, let us know. If we don't know you, we won't mail you our book to read. But check out your library. I used to see us getting an email from some total stranger in, like, I don't know, Europe. Can I borrow your book? No. But... If you don't know us, check out your library, see if they can interloan a copy for you.
Amazon has copies.
We'll put the website
up. I even saw one on eBay.
Yeah. So. And ours was like, what, $14 for shipping?
Yeah.
It wasn't expensive.
It's an average between 10 and 15. I mean, it's out of print, but it's not totally rare.
Well, ours was expensive too, because we had to ship to Canada. If you live in the States, you'll be able to do that a penny plus shipping thing from Amazon. So
buy $50 worth of crap and they'll send it for free kind of thing.
I think we're good. I don't have anything else to add. We've been going on for quite a while, even after we take off the pauses while we frantically look things up.
God save the Queen.
Amen.
And God save the good, fair, and cheer of old England.
So this is Tracy.
And this is Sheila. And we're Five Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed this Five Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.